ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
What is the simplest form of life? Today, even the simplest single-celled organism is an astonishingly sophisticated multi-part system consisting of a cell membrane, ribosomes, enzymes, DNA, RNA repair mechanisms, and much more. But according to the naturalistic origins account proposed by many scientists and science organizations, life must have been much simpler in the distant past in order for abiogenesis to work. But how simple can a living cell actually be? Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Eric Anderson, and on today's show, we're joined by Dr. Robert Stadler to talk about the origin of life and the effort to determine the minimal viable cell. Stadler received a degree in biomedical engineering from Case Western Reserve University, a master's in electrical engineering from MIT, and a PhD in medical engineering from the Harvard-MIT Division of Health Sciences and Technology. He has worked in the medical device industry for more than 20 years, has over 140 patents, and is co-author of the book, The Stairway to Life, An Origin of Life Reality Check. Great to have you back on the show, Rob.
Hey, great to be here, Eric. It's always fun to talk about the origin of life.
Absolutely. One of my favorite topics. So, Rob, I want to step back a minute and kind of remind our listeners where we've been in our discussions. We've had a number of conversations about the origin of life and the challenges for abiogenesis. I encourage our listeners to go back and revisit those discussions. While each of those conversations can stand on their own, there's an important connection that I just want to take a minute to emphasize.
Indeed.
Specifically, abiogenesis research today is really proceeding from two separate angles. And I'm not talking about, you know, metabolism first, RNA first, membrane first. I'm talking about at a high level, from a standpoint of the theory, the first organism on Earth must have been simpler, far, far simpler than what we see in life today. That's sort of a foundational requirement of the naturalistic origin story, because otherwise the theory can't be taken seriously. So there's a tremendous amount of effort to find this simplest living organism, or even we might say the simplest self-replicator, which is the holy grail of abiogenesis research. And it's imagined that once that simple self-replicator is discovered, then the magic of Darwinian evolution can step in and do the rest. All right. So with that background, there are two ways, I would say, that one can approach this question. We've talked several times, including last time, about what we might call the bottom-up approach to the origin of life. So we start with bare molecules, RNA polymers, and try to come up with a simple self-replicator. Today, what I'd like you to help us understand more about, Rob, is what we'll call the top-down approach, taking an existing living cell and trying to simplify it down in the lab to the bare bones where it could still survive. Tell us a little bit about that approach.
Yeah, it's fascinating, really. The last couple of decades have seen great progress here in finding the minimal viable living organism and even human intervention to simplify things down further, knocking out genes that they're saying are not necessary. And, you know, Craig Venter and his group at the Craig Venter Institute are leading the way here. And, you know, they published a while ago what they called the simplest form of life, which was they start with a Mycoplasma mycoides, which is a very, very tiny bacteria that you find in the gut of a goat. And they simplified it down from 901 genes all the way down to 473 genes. And they called that the JVCI SIN 3.0. And that was a nice accomplishment, really. But as we would predict, when you take something and knock it down to that kind of a minimal life form, it becomes very fragile and delicate. And so they found, you know, that it was alive, but it had irregular shapes. You know, it couldn't quite reproducibly form itself in the same shape, and it had vesicles forming in it, and it was called filamentation, which is when it kind of grows in a long stringy way, and it doesn't divide; it just kind of keeps growing as a string. So it wasn't great.
Yeah, not healthy for sure.
Yeah. So then they added 19 genes back in there to make it more robust and more like a laboratory study specimen. So you can argue about whether the genes they put back in are now essential or maybe just nice to have, but they made it more robust. And that led to this paper that we're focused on today, where they study, you know, how that new, this has 493 genes organism, if that's able to actually evolve.
Right. Okay. So we've got this organism that's in the lab that's being sort of coddled. Tell us a little bit about what it still has, at least in terms of its capabilities.
Well, it has all the things you mentioned. It has, the cell membrane, the ribosomes, RNA, DNA, repair mechanisms, even, it's required to have metabolic damage control. If the metabolism produces bad things, it's able to fix that and get rid of garbage, energy harnessing, all those foundational features for life are in there in a minimal form.
Yeah. And that's how many nucleotides? Do you know approximately how many we're talking
about? Yeah, it's down to 543,000 nucleotides.
Okay.
So a little over 500,000 nucleotides. And of course, we know that the nucleotides in the DNA are not the only information in a cell. There's information all over the place, but that's the easy one to quantify.
Yeah, so there's still a lot here. We've got over 500,000 kilobase, 500,000 base pairs of DNA. We've got all of these capabilities that the cell still has. So this wouldn't be, Rob, something that one would imagine on the early Earth, right? They're still trying to simplify it more and get something simpler.
Yeah, it's very much so. I mean, this is interesting to us because it provides a kind of a threshold of what natural processes would need to accomplish, just having basic chemicals bumping into each other and reacting. What would they need to get to before you could say, oh, that's life?
Yeah, right. And the reason it's able to survive, let me just emphasize this point one more time, which we've discussed in the past. The reason it's able to survive in this minimal state, even as significant as that is because it's being coddled, right?
Yes, in order to keep it alive, they have to, it's almost a hedonistic lifestyle. It gets fed everything on a platter, so to speak. I mean, all sort of pre-digested things. All of the cellular building blocks are provided for it in simple form. And it's at the right temperature, 37 degrees Celsius, just like a goat gut would provide, and no light. So that's what it needs to keep on going.
And the researchers are removing the waste products from the...
Yeah, that's a good point. So it's an obligate fermenter. So it only survives by fermentation, which produces acidic waste. And if you don't clean up the waste, it's not going to do very well. So every day they gave it a fresh new bath of the serum that it needs to survive on.
Right. Okay. All right. So I just want to point out that if we're talking about an organism surviving on the early Earth, it's got to do all this stuff itself. It can't rely on the researchers and the nice lab conditions to do that. But, fair enough. We're going to try within the lab conditions to see how we can minimize this cell and get to the point where we can find the minimal viable cell within our lab conditions, at least. That's fine. We can support that as a research effort for sure. So there's a recent paper that came out by, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right. If not, I apologize, Moger, Geit, Reischer, Glass et al., which is titled Evolution of a Minimal Cell. And this focuses on this top-down approach that we've been talking about and reports an exciting result, they say, that this minimal cell, after being disturbed, was able to regain fitness during 2,000 generations of evolution, which seems like a pretty big deal and pretty fast. Tell us a little bit about this paper.
Yeah, so the paper is titled Evolution of a Minimal Cell, and it's in the journal Nature in 2023, and it's open access, so it's pretty easy to just Google what I just said and pop it up. You could read the whole thing yourself.
By the way, is this part of Enter's team, or is this a separate group?
Well, it is associated with the J. Craig Venter Institute. So he's not an author, but it's part of his institute. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So this is continuing some of the research that's been done in the past that we talked about. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And so they took this very simplified cell and put it in this sort of hedonistic lifestyle for 2,000 generations, like you mentioned. And they did some good science here by putting the wild type, the original Mycoplasma mycoides, which is the one with 901 genes. And they also put that in, in a separate experiment, but in the same kind of growth conditions as a control group to see, what's growth like over here versus what it is for the minimal cell. And they defined fitness as simply the rate of replication. So forget everything else. All that matters is who replicates the fastest under these specific hedonistic conditions.
Yeah, and let me just this is a pet peeve of mine. So let me just point out this self-serving sort of circular definition of fitness has started to receive a lot of criticism, even from some prominent evolutionists, because if you're trying to get an organism that's going to actually function in the real world, you need to look at the function. And so this simplistic evolutionary view of just saying, well, whatever reproduces the fastest is the most fit is just preposterous. But anyway, carry on.
Well, yeah, you would think that they would throw some challenges at it, like, can you handle cold? Can you handle basic condition? You know, can you handle some kind of toxin thrown in there? That's fitness, I think, part of fitness anyway. But they got that all out of the way and gave it these hedonistic situations and just looked at the rate of replication. So the minimal cell, starting off at the beginning of this experiment, it took twice as long to reproduce as the wild type original one. And it was 30% smaller in size for each cell. And these are the smallest of cells. We're talking about 400 nanometers is the diameter of these cell. Really, really, that's really small.
And just sorry, Rob, just to clarify, for the minimal cell, you're talking about the 493 gene version?
Yeah, the 493 gene version. They call it JVCI-SYN3B. That's what they compared against the wild type. Yep. So after the 2000 generations, you know, drum roll, please, these are the results. The minimal cell actually increased its ability to replicate roughly back to where it began. So it approximately doubled its speed to replicate. But the cell size didn't increase at all. And now looking at the wild type, the original Mycoplasma mycoides, that one increased its rate of replication 30% more. So you could say it's 130% from where it was versus it's still faster than the minimal type. And the size of the wild type increased by 80%. So it increased its cell size and its replication speed, whereas the minimal cell only increased its replication speed.
Okay. So I know you're going to talk about the comparative here for a minute, but what's going on with the regular cell? Why is it, do we know why it's increasing in size and replication speed under these conditions?
Well, I think if you put me on a hedonistic diet where I could just lay on a couch and you fed me all day, I'd probably...
you might increase in size.
Yeah, and maybe replicate more often, maybe.
That's certainly, yeah.
So that's what happened. But one of their conclusions in the paper then is, this is the big message, is we conclude that adaptation was not constrained by genome minimization. So minimizing genes, throwing out all of that stuff, they're saying did not constrain adaptation. It's interesting they use the word adaptation here, whereas evolution is the term they use almost always in the paper.
Okay, so they're kind of mixing their terminology here a little bit. First of all, they were talking about fitness, which is just the sheer replication speed. And then they've said, okay, because the replication speed was able to, did it match the wild type or get close to it? Or
well, in the end, the minimal cell got back to what it used to be, and that's it. But the wild type went 30% beyond that as far as speed of replication.
Okay, but they were impressed that the minimal cell was able to increase its replication speed, which they were referring to as fitness. And now they're referring to that as some kind of adaptation and saying, what was the quote again? We conclude that adaptation was not constrained by genome minimization.
Yep, that's it.
Okay, well, that's a little, we could pick that apart maybe, but go ahead.
I think it's kind of a generous conclusion. I mean, adaptation, it was constrained in a lot of ways, I think, but it wasn't completely constrained. It's obvious that something changed, and so you can give it credit for that. But the cell size didn't increase at all, whereas the wild type increased by 80%. And also, this experiment just tested this one set of conditions. It didn't test any kind of real challenge. And also, one last point is that there's no indication in the paper that this minimal cell evolved any of the genes that were stripped out of it. you know, it didn't evolve them back, so to speak.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was going to ask you, whether there was any real new function that was identified or any real new information that was identified. It sounds like they were just looking at the speed of replication. It didn't increase in size. It just got faster. And they're saying, okay, that's a quote unquote adaptation. You know, let's go publish.
Yeah. And they didn't, I mean, they do give some details on what had changed within the cell, but there's no indication there that a new gene or any new information had entered the genome. It's more actually a devolution is what they have mostly specified in what they found.
What do you mean by that?
Well, by devolution, I mean that it's genes that are breaking actually. Like there is this one particular gene called FTSZ. And that gene, I would say, is non-essential because it wasn't in the original JVCI SYN 3.0, that one that was barely hanging on. But it's one of 19 genes that they added back in there to make it a more laboratory studyable specimen. And that gene is useful for helping it to build the membrane as it's replicating. And that gene was particularly hit by these mutations, actually with either a nonsense mutation or a stop codon mutation. So that makes the protein half form instead of fully form in a ribosome. And that changed the FTSZ gene. They actually tested it by prospectively causing that to an organism to see what it did. And it actually gave it a 14% gain in fitness right off the bat. So much of the fitness gain that they speak of is actually a hit to this one gene, ripping it in half, so to speak, and that somehow gave it a 14% fitness gain. They don't know exactly why, but that's what they found.
Okay, let me restate just for our listeners, see if I've got this correct. So there's this this gene called FTSZ gene, which we know is related to proper membrane formation because of the change from the 473 version to the 493 version of this organism. Okay, so we've got this gene that's related to membrane construction. Now, in the new experiment, they know at least that this gene was being disrupted in some way, either by a stop codon at location 315 or some other change that was affecting this gene. And by disrupting this gene, by disrupting its normal operation, the speed of replication increased, which they're calling fitness.
Yeah, by 14%. So
okay,
if you want to call that evolution, I guess you can, but I'd call it devolution.
Yeah. So you're breaking or disrupting this gene and the thing reproduces faster. Okay. But yeah, I see what you're saying. So that's a not a new function as far as we are able to determine, right? It seems to be a disruption, but it does result in faster replication.
And unfortunately, that's the only gene they really went into depth in. Did give some more generic results, and they said that they found that 16 genes in the wild-type organism and 14 genes in the minimal organism were also impacted, and they weren't the same. They were different sets of genes. But they didn't go into detail of what had changed and why that mattered. Except they threw in a little hint that it had something to do with lipid synthesis. That's about it. So I think there's more work to be done and maybe some assumptions made as to what these changes might have, you know, calling it evolution is, I think, an assumption here.
Mm-hmm. Well, so go back just a second here. When these organisms are in this situation, what's their replication rate or the error rate of replication here?
Yeah, that's interesting because this Mycoplasma mycoides, the original wild type, I guess you could say it's the Guinness Book of Records holder for the sloppiest DNA replicator of known living things. It replicates DNA and it makes one mistake, so one bad nucleotide out of 33 million that it replicates. And that sounds like incredibly accurate replication to me, but in the world of living things replicating DNA, that's as bad as it gets. One out of 33 million are misplaced.
Okay, so in human terms, if I'm typing a page, what do I have to type out to hit 33 million pages or 33 million letters?
If you took something like more than 100 novels and you just had to take your keyboard and retype over 100 novels, and you made one typo, that would be roughly one out of 33 million characters missed. So that's pretty darn accurate.
Yeah. Sounds pretty good to me too, based on my typing. But okay, so you're saying that this is the worst, it's the worst organism we've got.
And I think it's fascinating to compare this to the bottoms-up approach that you mentioned in the beginning, where some people think that just chemicals bumping into each other, coming together, can make RNA and can make self-replicating ribozymes or enzymes. And we recently had a conversation about a paper from Gerald Joyce's group, and it was, you know, a very impressive RNA molecule that could replicate other RNAs. And that thing, just for comparison purpose, that ribozyme, a piece of RNA that's used to replicate other RNAs, it made a mistake in one out of 12 nucleotides.
Yeah, well, that's worse than my typing, Rob.
One out of 12 is pretty bad typing. Yeah. And, you know, they admitted in that paper, this is a quote from the paper, they said, "The fidelity of RNA polymerization should be considered a major impediment to the construction of a self-sustained RNA-based evolving system."
Yeah.
So this shows where we're at from bottoms up, is we have one mistake out of 12. Versus the top-down approach, looking at this minimal cell, it makes one mistake out of 33 million. Mm-hmm. So you see the gap here between what can be done by simple chemicals and what life needs to do.
Yeah, that's a huge gap there. That's an important point, this brick wall that they've hit on the bottom-up approach. Okay, so even with this one out of 33 million, which sounds pretty good to us, the authors are suggesting that given the number of generations, I think about 2,000 generations, you said, and the number of organisms in the culture, that it would be able to sample every position numerous times, right?
Yeah, they claim in the paper that each and every one of the 540,000 nucleotides in the genome would have been mistakenly changed at least 200 times during the course of the experiment.
Yeah, and then they have this quote that says, "Neither cell type," I guess referring to the wild and the minimal cell, "would be limited by the availability of genetic variation to fuel adaptation," which if they're just talking, I guess, in the very narrow sense of, hey, in this experiment, all of these nucleotide positions could have been sampled, and therefore this they could have all contributed in some way to this increase in replication speed. Okay, that's fine if that's what they're saying. But if they're making a broader statement, Rob, that this gives rise to the ability to this organism to go on and adapt and become better and improve, what's your view on that?
Yeah, well, what they're talking about here is individual independent changes in single nucleotides. And there's plenty of that, if you call that variation. But to build up a new gene or a new function, of course, you don't just need independent nucleotides. You need a cohesive information-containing structure that has a specific sequence of nucleotides. And that is super hard to achieve by just random, you know, lottery. So I think they might be overstating this here, where to make new genes, you got to have something more than just a lottery.
Yeah, and again, according to what we're seeing here, there's no evidence that there were any new genes or any new functions, in fact, created, but just a disruption of this FTSZ gene. Not a real impressive, and as you say, maybe even call it devolution. But there's another issue here. You know, even with this disruption of the FTSZ gene, you and I were talking earlier, is that random? Do we know that that's a random change in what was going on there?
Yeah, when people speak of evolution, they speak of random changes and natural selection. But are they really random? Or is the organism, does it have a built-in ability to change the genome to its own benefit, which I would call more adaptation, and in preferential ways that can handle stresses? Mm-hmm. And they don't really call that out. It's difficult, of course, to show that it was truly random or more of a preferential change to a genome. But a little bit of evidence that it may have been a preferential change at a certain spot is that FTSZ gene often was hit in that location 315 there, Maybe it was random, but maybe the organism purposely changed things there for its own benefit, which I would call adaptation, not evolution.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like there might still be some additional work needed to pin down whether this change, particularly at 315, which suspiciously looks like it might be a little bit more than non-random, but it sounds like there's more work still to pin that down.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's difficult.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rob, for walking us through this. What's your takeaway from this experiment?
Well, it's clear that this minimal organism can change, and it did. You can't argue that. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to me that a lot of the change came from this FTSZ gene, which I would call non-essential because it was added back into the already living organism. Other changes were detected, but they didn't really characterize that. We kind of discussed this, that what we're seeing here, it's called evolution in the paper, but I think that's a stretch. It may be better to call it devolution or adaptation than evolution, because there's really no evidence of innovation. There's no new genes, or certainly not restoring the genes that were stripped out of this poor bug. And I would love to see additional experiments where they try different kind of stressful conditions. You know, maybe change the pH or change the temperature or put in some kind of toxin and see if it can survive compared to the wild type. So in the end, I'm not too thrilled with their conclusion that when they say that the adaptation was not constrained by genome minimization.
Yeah, it's a very narrow, if we were to rewrite that statement, we might say under these very specific lab conditions, the cell was able to increase its replication rate. I mean, that's the conclusion, right?
Yeah, that's a sober judgment of what they actually found. So back to the big picture then of how this study provides a kind of boundary of, or a threshold, I guess, of where simple chemicals would need to get to in order to call it alive. There's certainly more work to be done here, but I feel like over time, we're inching closer to defining this threshold, and we're now at 493 genes and 540,000 base pairs of DNA, quite a complex organism. And I would say, you know, this goes along with my belief that abiogenesis is not scientifically tenable, that you just could never have natural processes, just physics and chemistry on their own, that could get to that level of complexity.
Yeah. So let me just on that sort of point, big picture here, one of the quotes from the paper that jumped out at me is they said, if we assume that our findings are somewhat general, it appears that cellular functions are robust to streamlining over time, which is desirable when using minimized cells for biotechnology and bioproduction. Unpack what they mean by that, and then what's your take on that?
Well, it's been proven that simple bacteria, they like to actually streamline their own genome. If they don't need a gene, they'll just get rid of it. They'll jettison it because it makes them simpler and easier to replicate, faster to replicate. So out there in the wild, bacteria are trying to be as simple as they can be. And so human efforts to try to further simplify that life, I don't think are going to go very far, because the world is already producing minimal things on its own, and they're doing okay. As long as they can survive, they'll keep on doing it.
Yeah. But they're talking about, if I'm understanding what they're trying to argue here, they're saying that cellular functions are robust to streamlining. I mean, it seems like they've jumped from faster reproduction to calling that fitness, to calling that adaptation. And now they're even saying cellular function is robust. And they've kind of done I don't want to call it a bait and switch. I don't know that it was necessarily intentional, but I think they're sort of, maybe their viewpoint of how evolution must be working is coloring their view that they're saying, well, we've now got cellular function, when in fact, the only thing we've seen so far is a disruption of this FTSZ gene, and kind of saying that, hey, since cellular functions are robust to streamlining of the genome, then hey, you know, you know, this is great. This is amazing.
Yeah, I think as you said before, you should put a little asterisk on that statement they made and say, under very limited specific hedonistic conditions, we think that streamlining is maintaining function, but maybe not when conditions change.
Yeah, and maybe not even maintaining function. I mean, something's going on to disrupt this FTSZ gene. Okay, it's going faster, it's reproducing faster, but that's probably because they broke something. So anyway, I found this quote to be a little bit, you mentioned when we were talking earlier, sort of junk DNA, you know, the idea that, hey, if we're losing genes and reproducing faster, that we're evolving.
Right. That's not a robust way to get things done, right?
not a recipe for progress. Okay. Well, any final thoughts, Rob?
No, I'm just very excited to see more work like this come out, because it really does help to define this boundary of minimal life. And I think it helps to clarify the great challenge that abiogenesis has to face.
Yeah. And again, for our listeners, I want to emphasize we're not, I'm laughing a little bit at the conclusions here, but I want to emphasize that this is good work that's been done. We're not criticizing necessarily the fact that they're working on this. This is exciting research. We want to see more of it. But the conclusions and the way that this is spun as some kind of, great triumph for evolution and abiogenesis is really, I think, not supported by the facts.
Agreed. Yep.
Well, thanks, Rob, for being with us today to help us understand more about the minimal cell. This was fascinating.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. To learn more about the origin of life, visit us at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app. And as always, consider sharing a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.